Thank you. Our next speaker is Fred Hartman. He's an infectious epidemiologist and program manager for Management Sciences for Health, and he serves as the global technical lead for communicable diseases and epidemic preparedness, and the regional portfolio director for East Africa. In this capacity, he both provides communicable disease technical assistance and program managerial support to projects in East Africa, including the Sudan Health Transformation Project, second phase. He will be speaking on increasing DPT-3 vaccinations in post-conflict southern Sudan.
Thank you very much. One clarification, while I like to think my personality is infectious, I think I meant to say infectious disease, epidemiology.
Okay.
Infectious.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't see where it yeah.
It's okay.
Infectious
MSH has been in South Sudan since 2009, implementing the Sudan Health Transformation Project. There's a lot in a name. I have been doing this work over 30 years. I've worked in integrated projects, I've worked in extension projects, I've worked in primary healthcare projects. I've never before worked in a project whose name says we're going to transform the health system. So we had a daunting task to begin with. I want to thank all the collaborators on the development of this program on which we're going to report, who are identified here. We also want to express appreciation to Johns Hopkins. It's interesting that we're together on the program because, of course, MSH has been in Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban. I myself was there for 3 years, 2003 to 2006, and much of what we've used in South Sudan we actually perfected in Afghanistan. And we also work in the DRC and to some extent in Liberia. And I can truthfully say that regardless of the culture, the continent, or the language, post-conflict settings are very similar and have a very similar set of challenges. A lot of people don't realize how big South Sudan is now that it's achieved independence. Of course, this is the north. All of this is Ethiopia. I don't want to hit people's heads. But here is some of Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, the DRC, and the Central African Republic. In fact, all of this along here is the area of the Lord's Resistance Army. I've had some very scary drives here. It takes almost 2 days to get along here, and there's only one road. There's only one road. Here's Juba up and one road out. So access to this very large and dispersed population is quite challenging. We worked in 14 counties in South Sudan, and they may look like a random, almost dartboard, but in fact, at the beginning of the project, the government wanted all 10 states of South Sudan to be represented and selected counties from each of the 10 states. The counties were supposed to serve as model counties for the state Ministry of Health to adopt best practices. This is a South Sudan health status, which was based on a survey in 2006. The maternal mortality, as you can see, is quite high. It's considered the highest in the world. I truly don't believe the infant mortality and child mortality statistics. I think, in fact, they're probably at least 50% higher, if not 200% or 100% higher. But what you do see is very low immunization levels, very low antenatal care, extremely low contraceptive prevalence. And these were the challenges that we faced at the beginning of this program. By the way, I have consistently in the last year in meetings with the ministry quoted the Afghan mortality study. And if you haven't read it, please do, because it, again, was done by Johns Hopkins. Thank you. Again, an honor to follow you. That showed that with similar maternal mortality rates within 10 years, we were able to get them down. I would say below 500 is a safe statement. There's some controversy about the exact number. And we were able to reduce the child mortality almost in half. And thus, the reason for pursuing the technical approaches in the South Sudan. From the beginning, South Sudan openly admired Afghanistan's approach and adopted the basic package of health services. You see all the seven key interventions listed here that we focused on throughout the course of the project. And I stress the concept of integration because that's so critical to the success of our DPT-3 program. DPT-3 is more like a almost a bellwether of how well the system is doing, of how well the services are improving, and I'll get to that in a minute. We had two other result areas, the first being to implement the VPHS and increase access. The second was to increase knowledge and demand for health services, and the third was to improve the capacity of the South Sudanese to manage the health system, so that the project was in fact both a health service delivery program as well as a health system strengthening program. So in order to improve the basic package of health services, as I said, DPT-3 being one of the key indicators, we implemented four key technical approaches, all of which fit together. One is a standards-based management performance quality improvement tool that we call the fully functional service delivery point. That's quite a mouthful. At one point in Afghanistan where we perfected this, I recommended we changed it to a systematic performance improvement tool, but since the acronym was SPIT, nobody wanted to adopt that. Like Afghanistan, we did use performance-based contracting to NGOs. The government did not adopt a formal policy of contracting out. In fact, their policy is that they will provide the services ultimately, but they never were in a position to do that during the life of the SHTP2 and probably will not be for the next decade. So we did contract out to nine NGOs, and we set performance standards, which we believe are highly applicable to a post-conflict setting when the performance standards are tied to reimbursement, and I'll get to that in a minute. MSH is also known for what is now the Leadership Management and Governance Program. Was the Leadership Sustainability Program before that, and there were a number of previous incarnations. But one of the key tools that's been developed is the Leadership Development Program. I go back to Result 3, which is improving the capacity of the South Sudanese government to manage the services, the LDP. Highly effective tool. It is, in fact, a quality improvement tool. It does improve management and leadership, but it's based on the challenge model, where you select a challenge, for example, very low contraceptive prevalence or very low immunization rates, and then the work team comes together around it and addresses an action plan to overcome the obstacles, sets benchmarks and such, and we work with them to help supply whatever support may be needed. So it's both a capacity-building tool, but as well, it does help improve performance and services. And then, of course, monitoring and evaluation was a very key in performance-based contracting. You have to be able to monitor progress and evaluate where the performance is and in order to make sure that people get paid. In addition, the key issue was meeting every quarter with both the State Ministry of Health and the county health departments to basically use data for decision-making. We would give them their results, have it compared to the national norm of the project, and ask them to design specific action plans to bring their indicators up to the at least the medium of the project. In terms of EPI, and ask them to design specific action plans to bring their indicators up to the Ministry of Health to improve the cold chain. As most of you know, after 35 years of constant conflict, most health facilities had been destroyed or were in very poor repair. It's the same in Afghanistan or the DRC. And energy, electricity specifically, is very weak and infrequent. And cold chains are very weak as well. Not only do they not have the equipment, but they tend to burn out due to low voltage, and we had to rely more on the use of kerosene and even solar refrigerators. After all the years of war, many of the staff were doing the same thing they'd done for the last 20 years, so we developed a very strong in-service training program. And in terms of the EPI, we focused on training vaccinators and supervising and mentoring them, and training the staff on vaccine logistics. When we started, there were a large number of stockouts of vaccines. The Ministry of Health, in general, has a push system for supplying essential medications. That is to say, every quarter, they send a kit full of medicines out to each health center, whether they need it or not. And the medicines in there are set at the central level, again, whether the health center needs it or not. And so people got used to just receiving the medicines automatically every quarter. We, however, for vaccines, implemented a pull system, which was based on utilization, the number of immunizations given in the previous 3 months, current stocks, et cetera. And there was a lot of training involved in switching mentality to that. When we started and we would meet with the NGOs, the subcontracting partners, we called them, a lot of complaints about us not helping them with the stock outs. And we had to turn that around and say, hey, folks, this is a pull system. We're training you in how to measure your stocks, how to forecast, and it's up to you. If you have stock outs of vaccines, it's because you haven't worked the system right. And I can tell you, within the life of the project, that completely reversed in terms of stock outs of vaccines were virtually non-existent. And I just bring that up about how easily people get into almost a logistical mindset that others have to provide us the support to make it work, and you have to sort of change that around, that stock outs are within your control. The other strategy we emphasized was sending cold boxes out full of vaccines on Monday morning and picking them up on Friday afternoon. Now, that's very labor intensive and expensive, but where you don't have cold chain, what that did was converted communities which relied on campaigns to fix facilities. And we feel that's a pretty dramatic change in approach. Once mothers know that a facility, even a small health unit with just one person, with what's called a community health worker, has vaccines every day of the week, they use it. When it's a campaign and you're only going to arrive maybe twice a month, they don't use the facility. So we feel that the reason DPT-3 became sort of a bellwether of systems improvement, by having the vaccines available 5 days a week, every week, mothers got used to bringing their children in, and then we used that as the opportunity to give them vitamin A, nutrition counseling, talk a bit about reproductive health, family planning, antenatal care, all of these things that we felt we wrapped around the immunization, and I think considerably enhanced the system's improvement. And then through the course of the 4 years, we developed a program for home health promoters. Now, in most countries, Afghanistan being one of them, these would be called community health workers. In South Sudan, a community health worker is actually a paid position in what's called a primary health care unit. So what would be volunteer community health workers are called home health promoters. And so we found when we started, much like existed in Afghanistan, the DRC, every NGO was doing their community mobilization, their community health worker or home health promoter, or some are called community-based distributors, according to their own really program priorities. Each NGO had been doing this for 20, 30 years, so they had it down pat. The problem was, if you went to each county, each state, everyone was doing a different thing. So over the course of the 4 years, we were able to transition to one system for all states and counties. And just as the project was closing in July, The Ministry of Health approved our program for national distribution. So that now there's a national program for home health promotion to go out, basically, get the mothers to come in, bring their children to the facility for their immunization. Now, this shows you what are pretty dramatic results. This is where we started, what I showed you, at 20%. So you can see between 2006 and 2010, when the project had its first full year, there wasn't much of a change. But look what happened in 1 year. Truthfully, this dramatic improvement from 29% to 70%, I believe, was a direct result of the project interventions that you've seen and the implementation of performance-based contracting. We then finished up at 86%. So really, in the course of 2 years, we went from 30% to 86% coverage of children under one. Fairly unprecedented. We did do this somewhat in Afghanistan, but it took a little longer. We did it in 2 years. I think it took 3 to even 4 years to reach this level in Afghanistan. Now, here is the DPT-3 coverage, starting where we were and moving up. And again, in here, we are implementing all the programs I talked about, turning rural units into fixed facilities and the like. This is very interesting here, because this is the quarter that included the vote for independence. So you can see how the country's attention, including all the health workers, was diverted elsewhere. But what is interesting to me is after the vote for independence was held successfully, we went right back up to the sort of slope of change. And then I want to talk a little bit about performance-based contracting, which we have used with great success. We believe it can work. What we did is we linked the payments to performance through this formula here. And basically, we set up an NGO scorecard. We had done this in Afghanistan. You can have a community scorecard too. But we selected basically 8 indicators out of our range of 16 that we felt were representative of the major programs, DPT-3 being one of them. And we applied a formula for target achievement. And basically what it amounted to is if a subcontracting partner in any quarter achieved less than 80% of their eligible score, they were dinged 5%. They lost 5% of their payment. If they got between 80 and 100%, they got full payment. And if they got above 100, they got 106% of the payment. Now let me show you what that means. Right here is where we trained the NGOs on this system and notified them that we were going to implement it, and then this is when it was implemented. So you can see a very dramatic increase once we implemented that performance scorecard. And then even though there was a drop-off here, went right back up. We believe that this was a very powerful stimulator to compress the amount of time it took to get over 80% coverage. We would have gotten there, but I think the performance-based formula compressed it to like a 2-year period as opposed to a 3 or 4. And remember, in a post-conflict situation, you're really in an emergency situation. I mean, the rates of maternal and child mortality are so high that, you know, you really don't want to wait the 4 or 5 years to develop the system. You're talking about emergency interventions. Now, let me go back a little bit. In the first couple of quarters of implementing this, we had 3 partners which got penalized. And in the first quarter, nobody got a bonus, okay? By the second quarter, 2 got a bonus. And by the third and fourth quarter of implementation, half of them were getting performance bonuses, and that continued on through the project. No one got a penalty payment after the second quarter of implementation until the final year. In the final year, the last 2 quarters, 1 out of the 14 refused to negotiate a subcontract with a penalty payment. They just refused. And we were faced with a situation. We either had to cancel their contract and take it over or eliminate the negative payment the negative incentive for everybody, which is what we did. And you know, in the last quarter, four partners were under 80%. It hadn't happened for a year and a half, but once we eliminated the negative incentive, it was the last quarter, the project was ending, it's not going to cost us anything, so hey, you know, why bust our butts to get out there and perform? So, so by the end of the project, 75% of our vaccinations, and it's DPG-3 is just a measure of the whole EPI program, were at the fixed facility. We had made significant improvements in the cold chain. I already talked about the cold boxes transforming a primary health care unit into a fixed facility. Most of our EPI visits occurred through the fixed facilities, not through outreach campaigns, but still, we needed outreach campaigns. There were 400,000 refugees coming in. There were marginal populations. We still had to rely on those. But what was most important is what I pointed out earlier. We were able to integrate services, and thus, we feel this program influenced increases in malaria coverage and IPT2 and family planning counseling. This is not an antenatal care presentation, but I can tell you the antenatal care went up just almost identical to the DPT3. The IPT2 did. It just went up in the very same fashion. And we had a very, very, I think, impressive end of project report on our achievements. So our lessons learned that, especially in a fragile state where cold chain is very weak, it can be complemented by these cold box delivery, that the vaccine supply is essential. Again, our message, performance-based contracting, does work in post-conflict situations, and it accelerates coverage, but supportive supervision and mentoring is essential. And that's the reason I pointed out the difficult transportation. I mean, our supervisors would be gone for 2 weeks. It's every bit as bad as Nepal when we worked in Nepal and we'd send supervisors out with backpacks and tents, and people would have to go out for long periods of time because once you get out there, you get stuck. I myself flew a plane to Wau, which is up by the border, because I didn't have the time to do the trip. And we get on the plane, which is a World Food Program plane, and I'm sitting there, and I look out, and there's a flat tire. Now, I've been doing this work for over 30 years. I've never had a flat tire on a plane. But it turns out they just can't fix a flat tire. They had to fly a certified team of technicians in a new tire, and that was Friday. And, you know, they couldn't do it until Monday and such. So I said, hey, okay. We called up our subcontracting partner, which happened to be JSI, and said, hey, can we use your project vehicle and drive into Juba? And they said, sure, no problem. Well, the no problem took 2 full days. We left at like 10 in the morning and got in at like 9 o'clock at night. And along the way, we must have seen maybe 20, 30 trucks overturned because the road goes through the central swamp and it's all up and down and these trucks just fall over. Very frightening road. And in fact, in the week after that, the minister of health broke an arm in an auto accident on that same road. So I think these achievements can be done even in extremely difficult and challenging circumstances. So thank you very much.
Fascinating.
Very interesting. I happen to have followed the introduction of the BPHS in Afghanistan and the RBHS in Liberia, and I look forward to someday following the program in South Sudan. Well, last but not least is Mary Carnell, our next speaker. And aside from what I'm going to read about her bio, this now represents not quite 30 years ago that we piled in a car with Marianne Mercer and some other people as students and drove up to Montreal to attend the APHA meeting there in 1982. So I think we're marking an anniversary. Dr. Carnell has spent over 25 years working in maternal, newborn, and child health in every geographic area of the world.
She is a physician with an MPH who completed her residency in preventive medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health. I think you see a theme here. She lived 15 years overseas as director of USAID-funded projects in Bangladesh, Madagascar, and Ethiopia, and lives in the United States now since 2006. She is currently JSI, for those of you who don't know, that's John Snow International, Center for Maternal, Newborn, and Child Health. And she's going to be speaking on adding value to Ethiopia's Health Extension Program Impact Evaluation of the USAID ISHE project.